My name is Carla Lewis, and I'm the Gainesboro Branch Manager. Today is December the 16th, 2006, and I am going to interview Dr. Walter Clater. Dr. Clater, when and where were you born?
I was born in Roanoke, Virginia, 406 North Jefferson Street in Roanoke, Virginia.
Okay, can you tell me something about your parents? Let's start with your parents, and then we'll go to your brothers and sisters, where they lived and occupation.
Okay, my dad was one of 13 children from Floyd County, Virginia. It's up down the road from where you're living now at the present time. It was 10 boys in the family and 3 girls. At the time, well, that's one step in front of slavery. His father was a slave, as well as mother. Came from over near Fern, Virginia, Callaway, in that section. Well, they lived there. All of them had taught school at that time. He went into medicine, and three others went into medicine, and they were farmers and school teachers and what I dressed up. My mother was from Knoxville, Tennessee.
Can you give me her name?
Roberta Morris Whitman. Most of her life was, I guess, Tennessee. Met my dad, and they were married in Bristol, Tennessee. And my mother's father was a Presbyterian minister, and they were friends to the Downings here in Roanoke at the Presbyterian Church. And my mother came up to visit the Downings, and whatever happened, my dad went to the train station with a horse and buggy to pick her up. And of course, he was immediately struck by her. And of course, he took the long way home to get there. So I don't know if you got all that history early or not, but that's the way they met. Of course, one thing led to another. And then, of course, they married in Bristol, Tennessee. And then she came to live in Roanoke with him. That first home was at the corner of Gilmer Avenue and Henry Street. I don't know if you were here at the time. The Dewdrop Inn was there or whatnot. That was a very prominent place at one time before they started urban renewal or whatnot. So they were there until they built a home at on Jefferson Street, and that was built around 1921 or 22. Very unique situation at that time. It was in the Jim Crow area at time. The house was too large for a black man to own. They didn't, couldn't find contractors that would build it. So my mother's father came to Roanoke and built it for her. And of course, they brought workmen out of Tennessee to come up here to do the job. That house ended up being one of the largest homes in Southwest Virginia, one of the finest, including even the whites in Roanoke. They never wanted to own up to it, but it was very much there. They had 22 rooms in it. And you work it out. Quite a large place in that day. And with the hardwood floors and central heat and things of this nature, in those days, blacks just didn't have homes like that, I'll put it that way. And it served served all of us, and that's what I said my mother kept us busy. Home was on a acre of land, and of course between cutting the grass and the upkeep and washing walls and whatever it took, cutting grass, it kept us all busy, so she knew what to do to keep us going. There's no doubt about that. So there was 8 of us that were born. The early ones were born in the home. Later on, they were birth would be Burr Hospital at the time after that was formed, you know, whatever. Anything specific with the mother or dad you want to know?
Your brothers and your sisters, can you name them or can you tell us a little bit about their occupation?
Okay. As I said, there was 8 of us, 2 boys, 2 girls, 2 boys, 2 girls. The 2 older boys finished medicine at Maryland Medical College. That would be Frank W. Clater and John B. Clater. Frank was in internal medicine, and John B. was in obstetrics GYN. Bernice, who was a girl, married a Lewis Body, and she was a medical technologist. Roberta got her training with Walter's teacher. She had her doctorate and whatnot in mathematics, and she taught in schools of Washington, D.C., whatever. She finished Chicago University, one of the youngest to do it, and had her first teaching experience was at Christiansburg Institute. And before she came, I think she finished around 21, 22 with all of this at the time. Brother Ralph went to Hampton, and of course, all of the boys had been previously in the military service. And of course, I was the fourth. My mother was determined to keep me out of it because I wanted to go. I guess the uniform, looking at the girls in those days, it's kind of, you get with the uniform, something you want to do, but in that thing. But I was looking at the seriousness of it. I was looking at the other end of it. So the way that went. But anyway, all of them except Ralph had gone to Knoxville College in Knoxville, Tennessee. It's a small Presbyterian college there. And they all, our connection with Tennessee, with the college, with my grandparents, that's where they had gone to school. Also, whatnot. Ralph went to the school where my father went to, which was Hampton Institute. I don't know if that was university or institute or whatever it was in those days, you know, whatever. My dad had taken his medical training at Shaw. He was in North Carolina, I believe, at the time. Ralph had finished I call him a mechanic, but they call it automotive engineering. A little fancy term, you know, for this type of thing that he worked out. And of course, when he came back home, he operated the service station that was on the property at the time. I went to Knoxville also. I only took 2 years, though. Then I went to Nashville on summer courses at Tennessee A&I. And then 4 years at Marriott Medical College for my dentistry. Finished also at the age of 21. Worked for the Borough Clinic when I first came home, and say for indigent children. That's before we got the clinic built, before I started to practice. It's, well, it was experience, but it was a donation, you know, for the kids that don't know. You know, they had nowhere to, but they had somewhere to go to, but money and things of that nature. Things was awful tight, whatever, that you do that. Then I was here 2 years, and then I also had to go to service. And spent 2 years in service, 18 months in Alaska, Alaskan Air Command. That's where I met the wife. Brought her, had enough sense to bring her to Mono. And he worked it out. And the first year after I finished, which was in 48, the clinic was built. And we moved into that January of 49. So I was there 2 years before we... before going to the military service, you know, came back. And then practiced there for 45 years before I retired, whatever. It brings you up to, what, 93, I guess it is, to work it out.
Okay, thank you. Did you have extended family living nearby, aunts, uncles, cousins?
That house during the time, between relatives and I guess the ministers and the doctors that came through town, and during that day and time, blacks couldn't just stay just anywhere that you wanted to stay. You couldn't go to the hotels. And of course, the Holiday Inns and those things were just beginning to come in later years. So usually you had to know some people, and you stayed with them, or you stayed at the church lot. Then a minute night, we slept in the car all night. Or you drive and you had nowhere to stay. And you spent the night on the road, so rather than do that, you go to a community and then you find a black section of town and you sleep in the church lot, in the car, or whatever, till the next morning. And then you drive. You also had to pick certain filling stations that you could go to, because all of them were, particularly in the South, they wouldn't serve blacks, or whatever, in those days when you had Ku Klux Klan and this kind of thing going on. So it had a hard life in some ways, but it's very interesting at the same time. It prepared you for other experiences and other things that will go along, you know, with you.
Can Can you describe your home life? You started describing your home at one time. For instance, did you gather around the radio in the afternoons? And can you remember when you had your first telephone?
Telephone was there all my life. I guess the patients would call my dad, and we had the drugstore down on the corner there, which was the it was Gainsborough Pharmacy, but that's not the first one. There was don't remember that. Anyway, Dr. Skinner lived up on Patton Avenue. 216 was the first pharmacist that was there. We ended up with Dr. F.A. Robinson, his foreman Robinson, was the pharmacist at that time. Most of our time with large family, but I also started to mention about the physician and the ministers or whatever that became. There's never been a time that I can remember that you didn't have 8 or 10 people sitting down at a meal, whether that's breakfast, lunch, dinner, or whatever. In reading the question, I remember one you asked, the fondest time, I think, would be when all the children were home, and it's something we've always done all our life with the parents, is to come home. It's not like kids today. They don't speak to each other. They don't know each other. But our family was a unit, and it was there. My dad, being a physician, he got up early in the morning. He went to the hospital, did his surgery or whatever. He had office hours in the evening as well as the night. And his time for rest or whatever was at 4 o'clock. And no matter where you were or what you were doing, you knew that he was coming home at dinner at 4 o'clock and you were to be there. Now, my mother didn't run the cafeteria. It's one of these things that each one eats at different times. You come in and sit down at their table, and you do not touch anything till my dad said, bless him. You know, everybody ate together, and this is where you talked or you whatever goes on for the day or whatever that you would have to do at that time. Thanksgiving and Christmas, my grandfather being in manual training and build or whatnot, we put the leaves in the table and stretched it out, and then the oblong. The breakfast room was a round table with leaves in it. They made a little selection to go through it. And you'd have 27, 28 people sitting down at a meal. You put a turkey on one end and a ham on the other, and that, it disappeared. And of course, the kids, we all had to help set the table, or you wash the dishes, or you clean up after, and this type of thing. But that would be my grandparents, my mother's father and mother that came when I was a youngster. My grandfather's people stayed there also, upstairs. You didn't have nursing homes and this thing. We all had to do this at home, and we were all taught that very young, you know, this sort of thing. The cousins that you mentioned, which it was several of them, they came down from Florida, Christiansburg or whatever, and stayed with us also. And of course, they helped out around the house or whatever work they could do. But this is where they went to school, to give them a training at high school or whatever. And they attended Addison, whatever. Most of us went to the Gainsborough School, and then we came up to Harrison here for 1 year, which is a junior high, I guess you call it. Only a year, 2 years, I think it was 1 year, and then went over to the old Addison, not the new one. That's where that was for the rest of our time, you know, that you spent in that regard. You got to pump me a little bit. I'm rambling on, but I think this is what you asked. It's what you wanted, exactly. What you're doing.
Okay. What kind of activities did you participate in?
You mean besides working?
Yes.
Well, during the late 30s, my parents had bought a farm out at Kingstown. It was about 18 and a half acres. And my mother fixed up, had a swimming pool on it. And she fixed up a thing that church groups would come out and have picnics and this type of thing. Of course, we worked out there with that. As the older kids left, well, my younger life was in Tennessee with my grandparents. And then as the older brothers and sisters left home to go to college, then the younger ones, like Sister Ruth and Ralph, and we came from the grandparents in Toronto, so we had to pick up where they left off to do the work. My days of high school, I think about feeding the hogs and milking cows and chickens. And I didn't have a chance to rip and run around town like a lot of kids, you know, did this type of thing. I always had chores to do and this type of thing. I didn't try basketball, but I did try football at the time. You know, whatever. And other than that, didn't have much time for anything else except working. When you talk about milking cows, that's a morning and night. That's every day. You don't put off. You got to do it every day.
Did you sit on the front porch or your parents sit, on the front porch in the afternoons when the chores were done?
I would say sometimes. That happened like that. And you know the house, you're familiar with it. The porch went around the whole front and part of the side. And yes, there was times that we would get that, particularly if the weather was nice, you know, whatnot. And of course, First Baptist Church was across the street from there. And of course, you know, you sit and talk with the neighbors, and people visit more in those days than they do today. Didn't have television, but you did have radio, but didn't mean that much, but it's just the excuse me. It's just that, well, my dad, if he didn't know them, they knew him. And this was just something that he just out there, the yard was full, church let out, and it's just something that you did. And that First Baptist was his church. My mother's church was Presbyterian, that's where most of us were. But Reverend James, as I remember, was the minister there. And you could go into First Church in the morning to go to Bible study or kindergarten, not kindergarten, so Sunday school.
Oh.
That's what I'm on my mind. This type of thing. But anyway, then service starts with 11 o'clock or whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, see, now my church, we are by 12:30, 1 o'clock. But you never get out of Baptist church till 2 o'clock or later. So then a funeral would come up, and you never know when the church service was over and the funeral started, because he never stopped preaching. And he tell the undertaker, just bring them on, and you come on into there and bring the casket on in, and he keeps talking. And it's been a minute day that they were over there at 5:30 before that church ever let out. So sometimes two funerals, and you just never know. So that's what I grew up with, you know, this type of thing. But many day, the people were there, the family, and you waiting for church to let out. They lined up waiting to come into the church. And he had never finished the sermon. And the deal came in, and he finally just told them, bring them on in, and just keep them on there, and they stay all day. That's the way. But in our day now, let me be honest about this. Well, I am honest, but I mean, I'm trying to fill in. By not having the different social places and the different things to go to do it in the black community, church was one of our central things to do. And as a result, if it wasn't in that, they made visits to the sick at the hospital and things of that nature, you know, to do it. But that was not only part of entertainment, but it was social, but it tied the black community together that we knew and they knew us. And that meant an awful lot. And this, I know one of the questions that you were asking about urban renewal, which comes down on the end, but that is a difference between white Roanoke and black Roanoke. There was two Roanokes. People don't know this. They don't want to recognize it. Blacks had their own things compared to the white side. We never had sewage disposal or water things. That's not what I'm referring to. Hospitals, yes. Banks, building and loan, eating places, things of that nature. You see, you know, that we had. And that's one of the things that I'll always feel bad about it in Roanoke, because they tore up one of the best black communities in the South. Now, that is no joke. You had more going for you in Roanoke than any community in the South. Bar none. I'm not talking about Atlanta now. No. I'm talking about our size. Atlanta is straight for blacks all over. Everybody knows that. Charlotte, Atlanta. Of our size, Roanoke, there's nothing to touch it. But that was destroyed beginning in the 50s. And it's still going on today because they still can't get Henry Street straight and what's going on. It wasn't that we tore it up. The whites tore it up, but not understanding what they were doing. And that is still going. Millions and billions of dollars been spent. in the town has been hurt by it, particularly the black community anyway. And it's the white too, because you've got a fourth or third of people that are against the city. That's bad, to my mind.
Did your family have stories that they passed down from generation to generation that you all still pass down today?
Or recipes? That depends on what kind of story you're referring to, Carla.
Something that, you know, every family would say, well, you know, your granddaddy was such and such, and they passed it down, and when you got it, you passed it down to your children. They would tell a story about their grandfather.
That gets down to whether you're referring to the truth or what you put on somebody, or actually has to hide words. All families have some kind of stories of some kind, but I would say the experiences. I don't necessarily say these stories, because we have some wonderful experiences and different things that have happened, and one that some of us even living, and you know, whatever cars fast driving them. Few wrecks in your life and going back and forth to school when you have all these different events. So, you know, different things happen. And I don't mean anything real bad, you know, type of thing, but it's just the average life of whatever, you know, that you're doing. But you always remember somebody did something and pulled a boo-boo, and you laugh and joke about it even today. You know, those type of things. But it's more family things. It's not a thing of talking about other people. It's just things that happen within the family, you know.
Let me narrow it down a bit. Maybe the Civil War would ring a bell, or slavery.
Civil War? Before my day, honey.
That's what I'm saying. The Civil War, the stories that passed down, you know, or slavery. You know, sometimes they had a story they would tell during slavery, how a certain person did certain things.
Not too much in slavery, in my deal. What I'm going to refer you to here now, and as you know, it's in your library. You have a book, Virginia Kaleidoscope. It should be Gainsborough. And there's one here at the Harrison Heritage. I know there are others in town that will give you all the history of the Claytors and a lot of other things, even more than I can tell you now, that goes. I can remember, as I said, my father's sisters, that would be my aunts, it was three girls and the 10 boys. They never dealt or dwelt with that type of thing. It's something that's not taught to us. We were taught to respect people. You do your thing, and if you do it properly, you don't have to worry about the rest of it. We rode the Gainsborough bus. It was all black anyway. We had no problem. Brougham Hospital made the circuit. We rode the front of the train. We rode the back of the bus. This type of thing. And when I came along, the library is not where it was at this time. It was across the street at the Ockfellers building on the corner. Miss Virginia Lee at the time was the librarian. And then her name was Beatrice Mitchell, but we only knew her as Sugar Mitchell. Was there for years. Where you are at the present time was a foundry. Now that land is owned by the Catholic Church and leased to the Roanoke City as long as they have a library there. The man that ran that foundry was named Shanks, and his kids would used to come down the hill on the weekends when they put the fire out, and they dropped the grate out of it and all this hot ashes and belted the iron or whatever. And they would empty this until next Monday, till they built the fire again. We saw all the sparks fly and all of this going. Well, that was fascinating to the children. And this is what we'd all end up when they shut it down for the weekend. First thing I could remember in learning to ride a bicycle was one of my first jobs. When I got out of school, my job was to deliver the medicine to people over the city that had ordered prescriptions or whatnot. You delivered in those days. You didn't have to necessarily have to go to the drugstore to get it. But that's one of the first things that I did learn the city at that time. You know, if I stopped and I played marbles or I played something in the street or whatever, but if anything happened, you better believe Dr. Miss Clayton, your son, they knew it. Yes, there was a phone. It didn't have to be the ringing kind, but whatever it is, the word got back home. But now I remember that very well. But that's the type of thing, but that's just the life. But colleges, everything was segregated, yes. But it's something to not let that bother you or stop you from doing. You don't go to places that do not welcome you through the front door. We don't go to the movies in the back alley and climb steps, this type of thing. If nobody wants you around, then you don't force yourself on them. You don't spend your money for people that don't respect you. That's just a training. You just don't do this. There's other places to buy or to do and whatever you had to do. And that don't mean every day somebody beating you in the head, eat this, that, and other. It's just some things that you grew up with that you knew. Being in the medical profession, in my life or whatever, it's always been a situation that someone needs your service or your help. I can remember my dad telling me when I finished medical school, he wanted to know where I was going to practice. And of course, at that age of 21, you've been scuffing all your life. The first thing, you've been studying. You haven't had a chance to get out and party and do the things that other people do and this kind of thing. It's a matter of money. And I received this lecture about that it's not about money, that you went into a service field. And that's what you are expected. I ended up in Roanoke. It's where you need it. So that's the way that works. I'm kind of filling up a little bit. I'm thinking about things. It's carrying me back a ways. But there were good times, you know, this type of thing. And it was true what he told me. It was something that it wasn't the money. Your pleasure will come from being well-respected. You will live a comfortable life. And it's kind of an honor of whatever. And that meant more to you than all the money they could give you. Exactly. And that's what happened. Some
exactly. Kind of that is exactly true.
It didn't work it out, but it turned out to be the truth.
That honor.
It's truth.
I know when you're talking about the honor.
I'll never forget it.
Okay.
And thought about it for years, but,
but you brought it back to me. Thank you for sharing it with us.
I ain't work it out.
Okay. What is your fondest memory during childhood?
Well, I think I've pretty much expressed it already. When your family comes in and all the kids come back, my brothers and sisters, grandparents were there. And I mean, you take 27, 28 people sitting down together. I mean, it's just like a picnic or something, you know, and everybody in the house and people coming and going. And that's just good times. Just, you know, it's not like I had to go out to look for it or this type of thing. And then not only that, all the kids up and down the street, maybe they would invite them, come on in, you know, you eat with them and everything there together. You play in the yard, playing football, this kind of stuff in the yard. But it just all kind of dovetailed into it. And never really thought about it. It's just something that you did. But they were full days and whatever.
How long have you lived in the Gainesboro area?
All my life, other than school time, you know, service. Yeah.
And you lived on?
It's 406 Jefferson Street.
Jefferson Street.
And then 802 Grayson.
Grayson.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Has the Gainesboro area changed much over the years?
Oh, tremendously. Tremendously. Let me see if I can separate Gainesboro from other parts. There's a situation of sections of town. I'm talking about Black Roanoke now. You had Northeast Roanoke, you had Northwest Roanoke, and you had West End Roanoke. They were Black. Henry Street was the middle of all of it, which was the center of the Black sections of town. Henry Street, one street, but that also was two streets. And a lot of our people don't understand this. On Henry Street, you had movie theaters, you had doctor's offices, beauty shops, barber shops, hotel, eating places, ice cream parlors, club, daytime activities. Now, nighttime, sun goes down, 10, 10:30, 11 o'clock. There's another street. That's where all the boozing comes on. The ladies of the night, if that's what you want to call them, or whatever. But the street jumped. This a different type of life. Women could go dressed daytime, whatever. Nobody ever bothered you. Nobody ever bothered you. You've probably talked about this. If anything happened and you go across the bridge to White Roanoke, that's the railroad track, divided you. They used to put up a little thing across there to block you off from going over as if that's going to stop you. If blacks wanted to go over to White Roanoke, that wasn't going to stop you. You know, as far as the thing. The only thing did at 10 or 10:30 that the police would leave. They would stay up there late at night. So every street was on its own. See, different, two streets. A lot of people, even the blacks, don't follow this completely. They don't understand it. But you had not just one doctor's office. You had several doctor's offices was on Henry Street. You had two drugstores, black drugstores up there. Nick's, all that wasn't black. It was, what are the Greeks or Lebanese Syrian. Or whatever. I don't know what the, Syrian. What they are. Well, Moses, that's
Syrian. They said it was
Syrian, I guess, you know, but they, all this, the grocery stores in the neighborhood, but they were all here too. But we got along, we played together, and all this bit. I never paid attention to what they were. They just there, you know, one of these things. Excuse me, but all that took place on Henry Street. Mm-hmm. All right. I can't say that any of it would be the Taj Mahal. None of it, they didn't make that kind of money. But what they did, and in many cases, all of this section here was part of the Gainsborough stop at Fifth Street as far as the urban renewal part went. But you had certain sections of town that the people took pride in their properties. Not only the home, the yards were kept up, they fixed up nice. You could go Gilmer Avenue just as nice as any street you want to see in Roanoke, white or black, whatever. Same thing as far as Harrison, up around the Borough Hospital section. Nice homes, this type of thing. Northeast was probably the first section of Roanoke, when Roanoke first came into being in 1887, I guess it is. And they used to call it the row houses down where the Gregory School was. Yeah, you don't know about that, do you? Something new for you. Okay. Those were the first homes of the railroad workers, north and western. And as they moved out, and then the blacks moved into that area, where the 581 comes down through by the graveyard that you hear in the paper just recently. Whites were buried on that side of it. The First Baptist Church owns the rest of that, where blacks are buried. They moved it, but that's where the First Presbyterian Church was located. That's in the history that I gave you some time ago on the Presbyterian Church. They put that church up on Oxcart and moved it over on Roanoke Street. And that was behind the present. They had a new brick church built at one time. Was that Second Presbyterian, whatever it's got its name, I don't remember what that is. But the black congregation on Reverend Hunter's church, what is that? Up in West End Roanoke. Gusty, what does that know? Is that Loudon or is that?
Loudon's on A Street.
No, wait a minute. It'll come to me.
Okay.
But anyway, they bought that church. That was the Sunday school for the First Presbyterian Church. And that's where they started their first church until they built it, the other one. That's where that came in. So that building was moved on Oxcart twice up to that place now. Okay, get back to the northeast. You see, that's the older part of Roanoke. As the whites moved out and the blacks moved into it. So that was the older section down around the gas company. This type of thing, the first urban renewal was in that part where the Civic Center is at the present. Now, the city promised when that was to be done that that would be rebuilt as a black neighborhood rather than the businesses that are down there. So once they got the land, then they reneged on it. As a matter of fact, the church, Mount Zion, Greater Mount Zion, had built where the Civic Center is today. because they thought they were going to be rebuilt. Then they had another urban renewal in a sense because the city, they didn't want to give them the money that they paid to build the church. So they all got fussed about it. So the city finally gave them extra money because they tore down a brand new church. They took that land for the civic center. And then 581 came through, so that wiped out the whole black neighborhood again. So that was one lie. The second one, Kimball, had followed that. Of course, that wasn't particular lie. They gave the people $4,000 more to help them with the transition of moving, because those in lower section there, they really got ripped off something awful. They had to go in debt. They lost everything they had, pretty much, and everything. Kimball, they gave them $4,000 more to help them with the move. In Gainesboro, which was the last one, they promised them $15,000. Some of them got it, some of them didn't. But the point that I was leaning toward is that the pride of ownership has been destroyed. You had the owners, you just look up and down the street, they don't take care of them, they don't paint them, they don't keep the yards. The promise was that they were going to fix up the place. Or if they're going to buy you out. Well, why fix it up if you're going to buy it? They had two houses adjoining. One lady had put a new roof on it and had fixed her place up and painted. The house next door to it, identically the same thing, same size lot, small lot, 40, 50 feet is all they had. She got as much for her place that this other lady just put $8,000 to $10,000 into fixing it up. Well, it doesn't take long for the word to go around. Well, what am I going to fix it for? They're not going to give me no more money. And that feeling is still today of what's going on. Now, they don't take the blame for it. They say, we didn't do it. But that's the way it goes. It's something we didn't do, but that's what happens. And this is hurting Roanoke even today. And something else that is not recognized, I didn't want to recognize it, they funnel us all up the Northwest Corridor rather than let you move wherever you want to go. You can't borrow with so much money. That's the way they restrict you and hold you down and this type of thing. So then, well, they don't want to go anywhere. They like to stay together. That's the word that they give you. You know, it's this type of thing. Blockbuster. Our people didn't go up to bother the whites that live up there in Rugby and all further west. They sent you up there, and they paid our people to go into those places to break up the lock. Because once the black move in, they know the whites going to move out. And where the city made their mistake, which I've always said a mistake, they know it now. They didn't know it at the time. They did not provide homes for the white folks in the city. Now, when they ran them out of the city, they took the money with them. Now the city, scrambling, need money. Now they're trying to fix the places up downtown and get these people back in here. But you ran them all out in the county, up in Wanda Park, and all over town, up in Salem, and all this bit. They carried the money with them. They kept the blacks, they kept the welfare, but the money left. Let's face it, you won't see that in the paper. They won't put that out for you. But you understand what I'm saying. Yeah, we didn't bother those white people. That wasn't the problem. If they had fixed up what they promised to do, we were perfectly happy. That's all they had to do was do what they promised. When the Civic Center, before it was built, the citizens had turned down the old American Legion Auditorium on two occasions. They didn't want it. So what did they do? They burned it. I shouldn't word it that way. It conveniently caught fire and burnt down. I think that's a better way of putting this. I can't say they because I don't know who did it. But anyway, it caught fire and burnt. They turned it down. So then they took that and moved it from, that's right down where the Hotel Roanoke is, you know what it is. That's where it used to be. It's a parking lot now. Then they built the Civic Center to work that in. Now they got a big thing going on now. They can't get the mine together. Roanoke is landlocked. You're either going down or you're going up. You add all this thing on the back of the Civic Center, you got no parking. How can you have affairs if you can't park to get to it? They built that other thing. They built it. They cleared the land across the Orange Avenue, that back of the other side of the graveyard. So if you had put the Victory Stadium or whatever it was over there. Where are these people going to park? What you going to do? You keep building it, but you got nowhere to park it. And if you can't get them in here by bus or train or something, what are you going to do? No, they're going somewhere else. But Roanoke is rapidly, I don't know where they're falling over their feet doing something, but they're not thinking far enough ahead. All of our people that, let's put it this way, when you move to places and all of our neighborhood, this is neighborhood businesses. All right, you got zoning to contend with. Now, if you had a grocery store in Northeast or somewhere, and they buy you out, and that's the only business you've ever done all your life, then where do you go? Now, if they move you up to Northwest or somewhere else, what land is available that's zoned that you can have your grocery store? Now, that's not a supermarket where people come from all over town to your place. That's neighborhood business. So if you take away the neighborhood, you've lost your business. My work, dentistry, same boat. I lost my business. Even though I'm a doctor, I lost my, and everybody else lost their business. At Burrell Hospital one time, you had 8 or 10 physicians, active staff, 6 or 7 dentists, black I'm talking about. Where are they today? Not only did the new ones come in and left Roanoke, then it was still the old ones to die. Or a couple of us retired, the rest of them gone. Nobody here. Those are the people that you have a question at. Who did you look up to? Who were your role models? Maybe in a sense, I'm a role model for some people, but they were also my role models because this was our community and this is what we had. At one time, you either became a doctor, you became a lawyer, or you were a school teacher. And that was the top 3 professions for blacks. But now it's open to a lot of things. Our best jobs in the years would be Norfolk Western. You had the silk mill, I think that was on your sheet. And those jobs offered you some type of retirement or something going on, but nowhere else you did day work, taking care of people's children, their homes, and this type of thing, but you had nothing else to live on. You worked all your life and did the best you could for as long as you could. That's the way it worked. So once you destroyed this, you took the business away. All children, my friends and whatnot, they had little jobs, whether you carried the groceries for people or whatever you did, or the families of those businesses, like in my case, there were several businesses within our block, but there were other businesses. This is where the children got the training to do things, to have business of your own. You didn't have central heat in a lot of places. You had coal stoves and wood, but you had some job to do to come in to get that fire going and have the ashes out and got ready for the next morning, you know, this type of thing. But kids had more to do at home than they do today. You don't set the thermostat and go about your business. You had things to do. The homes around this area, all of them, when I was a kid, had outhouses. You didn't have soda. All up Patton Avenue, outhouses. You had Guadoas. Now, at the park over at Washington Park, it's called. There was I thought it was artesian well. I didn't know any different. But that pipe with that water ran. All the kids around it from where we live here over to Addison had wagons. And you had these 5-gallon cans that you carried that you hauled water to go home. That's every day. You had to carry that water. And of course, the interesting part, the stories that you talk about, you want to get into some of that. See, that's where the bootleggers ran too. See? But those cans, and they stop them. They didn't know the kids, but the whole kids holding liquor. We see you open the top on one end, and that was water. But when you turn the can over, it's other than the liquor. We don't need to go into all that. You know, I start interested. I tell you all the things you can't know. But anyway, those were the things that took place in those days. It's in my time that I can remember when sewer lines and things were put in and people had bathrooms put into the homes. On the back porches or whatever. But those were outhouses. The house that my parents built, they have 3 bathrooms in it with tile floors and all this bit. Oh, honey, that was luxury. You live it, you know. It's one of those things. But that was wrong when I was born. They're not only blacks. I mean, a lot of that was in town. That's pretty much all over, this type of thing.
And did most of the families own their own homes?
A good many. A good many. They might have been the finest thing. All right, take all the homes up there, and most of them on Gilmore, they own it. It depends on your level or where you were. You might have had a mortgage for 20, 30 years but you owned it. And that's the way it went. But the point I was trying to make it, in case you missed, there were groups that took pride in what they were doing. It may not have been much, but they owned it and they took as best they could with it. A lot of them knew more about carpenter work or doing roof or painting. Kids today don't know how to do anything. They haven't been taught. They don't know anything. They've got to hire somebody or they don't know what you're talking about. They can't even fix a bicycle. But that's something we all did. We fixed our own things. You made scooters, the skates. I don't know if you remember this thing. You took a roller skate after you wore the skates out. You took the wheels and put them on a board. And you put the board up and you had your little scooter. You remember those things? Okay, well, see, we made them. But that's what we had as kids. You might have had an iron ring with a little wire on it, and that's what your toy was. But after you played this guy, you didn't have no computers and all this stuff. You got this stuff going on there. You didn't have, but nobody told you you were poor, but you enjoyed what you had. You know, we work it out.
And you said you remember the silk mill.
Oh, yes.
Okay, how did that affect Roanoke Valley, especially our community when it closed?
I would say the silk mill hurt Roanoke Valley, period, white and black. You had both people working at the silk mill. And they broke that off into 4, 5, 6 different businesses that's out there. But people on this side of town that worked at the silk mill, or if you got a job with Northern Western Railway, you were the hoi polloi. You were top of the line. That's where your salaries. You had better salaries and you had retirements, whatever they were, you know. You had in pensions, I'm thinking about. You had health care and this type of thing. And that was your better class of worker in that day. So when the silk mill closed, it hurt Roanoke. Most of the people in the Southeast worked in silk mill. And I was fortunate enough in my day as practicing dentist that 16% of my patients were whites. And a lot of them came from Southeast. So for me, in our work at our level, it never bothered me, black and white. If nothing else, one of the first things we learned in med school, the only difference was the pigment of your skin and this type of thing. And then when you go into anatomy, I've seen it all, so we skip all of that. It's no problem. I've been all of it, let me believe you. Yeah, just the idea of what's the sense of skin color, this type of thing. But that's the first thing that knocked out all doctors. Right quick. There's no such thing as the top of the line and thing. You're human, you're people, and you treat them as such. Yeah, very seldom you ever going to see a doctor that's going to pick up on, you know, this type of thing like that. They're people. And we were taught, in my case, was teeth, but that's connected to the body, and you've got to realize what that means to the rest of it. And those type of things, are, you know, go along in that way.
Thank you.
But see, they know that, in general, most blacks came to school, that segregation and all that stuff was ingrained in them from the time they were kids. That somebody's always told them that white's better, that you're not as good, and this type of thing. So that's when the first thing, when you go in to be a doctor, that they take some, you know, get you straight start with. There's no difference other than that color or the absence of color and the fact that you've got melanin in your skin. And then they tell you why it's so much better. I don't mean to low rate you now, but your skin, you don't have as many skin eruptions. You don't have the problems with our skin that your people do. If you red haired, if you blonde and all this stuff, and you out in that sun, you better get you some sunscreen quick because you in trouble. And you can stay out there all day. No problem. You know, Well, you still have to be careful. I don't mean that, you know, type of thing, but it's just difference of people. I don't say that down in the mouth, just being factual about it. Work it out.
Dr. Slater, what are the kind of jobs that the blacks have? You were talking about doctors and some work in the city,
You work with the city, the streets, that water company, gas company, this type of thing. Or I remember we had the little farm out there, and I'd go down on market and pick up what we call day workers. It was a lot of people that were interested in steady work all the time. They only wanted to work 3 or 4 days a week, and then he'd do what he wanted to do. He'd get drunk on the weekends, and come back Monday and work some more, that type of thing. We'd go down and pick up workers and, you know, things like that. So the farmers brought the produce into Roanoke, and a lot of that, I think the city priced them out of it in many cases. But our downtown farm section used to be a very bustling type of thing when I was a kid. A lot of the offices and things was down there, but now, except for novelty shops, and you got a few people come down and sell flowers and 2 or 3, you know, farmers, but you've lost all of that around Roanoke now. All the farmers have either stopped farming or they sell their lands for the development and things of this nature. And it's not only Roanoke, but this is hurting our country, and our politicians haven't awakened to it. I just heard the other day that we don't even supply enough food for our country, that we import it. I didn't realize that. But as we build up and you don't zone the land and you're giving up farmland, you're depending on other countries for your food. You are running into trouble in 50, I don't know how many years, but down the road, you'll be just like you are with the oil people. They control us. We act like it's not, but that's what the war is all about, is controlling that oil. They don't care nothing about Iraq. They want that oil, honey. The question, that's money. Black gold.
What are some of your memories of the Gainesboro Library and the Ginger White Lady?
Well, being across the street from it, let's face it, I'm in it. And of course, this business of with Ms. Lee was almost like a second mother to a certain extent. Not only to me, but all to the children. She was just that type of person, you know, type of thing to do. Then, you know, that building burnt. And then, of course, you got the building that you're in at the moment. I remember Dr. Paxton and Dr. Fears and different offices were up above there, whatever. At that time, the library was a little larger in this room, but it was just a one-room affair, you know, type of thing. But Ms. Lee was very diligent about keeping a lot of different things, particularly to the black race, about the events that took place and things of that nature, you know, in it. It was very good for me in a sense as I got older and I started practicing. And a lot of times, after you become a doctor and families begin to trust you, or they ask you for advice and, you know, things of this nature. And a lot of times the parents wouldn't talk to the children, but they would ask the doctor about different affairs, whether it was personal hygiene or whatever, you know, type of thing. And I consider myself lucky in a sense rather than get involved in it. Well, I got involved to a certain extent, but if it got too much, it had been worked out with Ms. Lee and Mitchell, that I could send the girls up to the library with the thing and let them get a little bit more, rather than give them my version. It's better for me to send somebody else get involved in this. But they were very good at that. You know, they worked it out. And I had 2 or 3 to come back later and thank me, because it kind of put them on the right track and not get in trouble. And the boys were pushing them at the time, you know, and that type of thing. And rather than to go too much into what to do and what not to do, and I just let the older women take care of it. They accepted it and worked it better, which took the load off of me, which I was thankful. And to work it out. And of course, being young at that age, see, all the parents wouldn't necessarily appreciate me talking to a high school girl doing this type of thing. I mean, I'm 21, 22 years old. And let's face it, I mean, that's, you know, I said, wait a minute, Walter, you know. And I sent them to somebody a little older and let them handle that. I wasn't married at the time, see. But even so, but at that age, that's just something. It just wasn't a thing to do. At least I didn't think it was. So we worked that one out.
Thank you. Who were some of the role models that you had when you were coming up?
Well, see, that's what I mentioned about all the positions, the dentists, and you belong to those societies. But I wasn't a society, but My dad belonged to all of it, my mother. And of course, in those days, I guess he had more home games. My dad was a great bridge player, mother. And they'd get together on occasion. The people would come to the house and they had these little card, you know, session bridge or whatever. They'd go to Dr. Robertson down. They just visit around, you know, whatever type of thing doing. And just different things of that. In my day, we came along with canasta and pinochle. You know, was more so than a bridge, you know, at the time or whatever. But it was more house parties, more church affairs. I say you didn't have TV, you know, this type of thing. We were busy. I mean, but you had more home chores and things to do. You didn't have the time to do a lot of this every day. Oh, I ain't got nothing to do. I'm bored. I've never been bored in my life. I don't know what you're talking about. Never had time to do the things I had to do. You know, it's a matter of entertaining yourself. And I think it's horrible if somebody don't know what to do with as much reading and as much things to do and you got to sit up and don't know what to do. I don't know what you're talking about. I've seen it. I've heard people talk about it. But I even retired. I wonder when I had time to work. Of course, I'm a honey do this and honey do that. You know, it's one of these things. But that's yes, sir. But it's something to do all the time. I guess this is the farm work. Now, I wasn't a farmer. But my dad, you know, dad came off the farm, my mother. We used to go to Florida and had a big garden up there. She piled us all in that car and we'd go up that mountain and you weed that garden and you do whatever you do and with everything working out. But there's always something to do from morning to night. I just don't understand what you mean you don't have nothing to do. It's never been my vocabulary, I put it that way.
Dr. Clater, is there anything you would like to tell us that we haven't asked or did we leave out anything you would like to say to us?
You got many more hours to stay here to do this? I think you got about as much as you can digest there. The only thing I would say to you that if you would share the book, Virginia Kaleidoscope, there's much more in there that I can possibly tell you. The only thing that's not in it that we've come up since then, we went into blood studies, DNAs. We know from the family that it's 69% European. We know that we're 29% from the Mendes tribe, which is Sierra Leone in Africa. And the other 2 or 3% is Cherokee Indian. And that's not in the book. But that's a continual thing we've been doing for 20, 30 years, is trying to get our history. As to whatever. But we've traced it back to, I think, the 17th century. And this is where the different marriages of the different nationalities of Europe, until the tours and the clays when they came to this country, and they combined the name, is where we got Claytor. And then they settled around the Bedford area. And then they branched out from there. And my father's father would be, no, his father, that would be Harvey Clater. On the farm over here in Callaway. That's the slave farm I'm talking about. That's where we all came from. And grandmother was a Garant. That farm he was, he didn't know it at the time, but he was, when I did this history on the church, Presbyterian, he belonged to that Presbyterian church over there as he worked it out. So it's been a, you know, thankful night. Been quite interesting. I've lived a full, interesting life. Still trying to make it, doing the best I can with my sore hips and whatever.
Thank you, Dr. Clater. We do have a copy of the Kaleidoscope at the Gainsborough Branch Library, and it can be checked out. And we thank you all for donating that. I think you donated one, and I think we bought one. So thank you for that, and we do have that copy. Okay. We appreciate your time.
It's a whole lot more than that. I can't tell you as far as the families, different things, the children, and as they came along, you know, and whatever, you work it out. But that book is in the library in Washington. It's been listed through the library as one of the best genealogy books in the country. So that makes us feel pretty good. Exactly. You work it out.
That is
good.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay.